Welcome to Dear Hank and John.
Or as I prefer to think of it, Dear John and Hank.
It's a podcast where two brothers answer your questions, give you dubious advice, and bring you all the week's news from both Mars and AFC Wimbledon. John.
Yeah.
Did you know, and I'm not making this up, I saw it on Twitter and then I fact-checked it, that according to Greek mythology, there was a half-horse, half-man named Chiron, or possibly Chiron, I don't know how to say Greek's words, who helped heal people and was in charge of, like, bringing medicine to folks, making this being the centaur for disease control. And it sounds like I made that up and just, like convoluted to get to the joke, but this is actually a thing.
That's a great, Hank, that's a great joke. Did you write that?
It's not a joke, one, and two, no, I didn't. Melinda Howard tweeted about it, and some people sent it to me on Twitter.
Okay, that explains it. So someone else wrote a great joke on Twitter that you then repeated, and that is a great joke. The centaur for disease control makes me briefly wish that I had Twitter again. Hank, speaking of which, do you know what I would have tweeted this week?
No.
Nothing.
Ah, that would have been a great call.
I would have just stayed clear of the entire service, which is indeed what I did. Hank.
Yeah.
We record this podcast in the past.
We do. Yes.
And so
it's probably for best for our emotional health.
For sure. But people always think that we're responding to, like, a particular event when we express a level of discouragement or fear or whatever. But we never are responding to that event because we recorded the podcast so distantly in the past that we don't know what happened that people think that we're referring to.
Yeah.
So let me just say about whatever happened this week. Oh, my God. This is all so horrible. I feel very discouraged, and I know that I'm not supposed to, and I know that, like, the data tells me that life is getting better in every way, but I can't help myself. I feel a little discouraged.
I feel you. And there are a number of people who I wish would take your advice, and maybe even me, maybe. But I've had the thought several times this week, how do I keep this person from tweeting? But of course, that's not my job, and probably shouldn't be. probably shouldn't have that responsibility. But boy, I saw a bunch of zingers recently and would rather not, and also would rather people not call attention to them oftentimes and give them even broader audiences.
People love bad hot takes, but the only thing they love more than bad hot takes is the bad hot take takedown of the bad hot take.
Yeah.
And
it's true.
If you want to be the number one trending topic on Twitter, your best strategy is to have a bad hot take that lots of people can then have bad hot takes on.
Yeah, that's so true. You're going to hear more about my experience with that on last week's Delete This.
Great. I also have a podcast. It's not about Twitter. It's called The Anthropocene Reviewed. Yeah, and the Daily really Beast just called it, I want to get this quote correctly because it hurt my feelings.
Perfect. Let me read you some Goodreads reviews in the meantime. Is that what we're doing?
They called it deeply weird and nihilistic.
I disagree. I think that...
I know. I'm trying so hard not to be nihilistic.
Yeah,
like, all of my mental and emotional energy goes into not being a nihilist.
One of your recent episodes was one of the topics, but then... You turned it around. That was the whole thing. That was the conceit of the episode.
All right. You don't have to make me feel better about my deeply weird nihilism. This first question comes from Ola, who writes, Dear John and Hank, the wheel is a superior way to get around, yet evolution hasn't gotten to it yet. Animals move around with feet and fins. There are no natural wheels. Why? Sincerely, maybe your only Norwegian listener, Ola. Not pronounced like cola.
Uh-oh.
Crap. Ola.
That message was from...
Ale.
Ola. Ole.
Ola.
Ole?
Ole. Ole.
Ule.
Ole.
So you gotta give us more than that.
Ola.
You can't tell us how it's not pronounced.
Ola.
You're just leaving us in this,
I got
this
it,
dirty,
I
dirty
got it. It
ditch of
second.
Bad ulas.
No, it's ola. Ola.
Okay. John, you hit it right on the head there. I love it. I forgot the question because we spent so much time talking about...
Why are there no natural wheels?
So there are natural wheels in a sense.
What?
There's two senses in which there are natural wheels. One is that when different animals run, the movement of their feet actually, when a human runs, the movement of the feet actually sort of replicate a piece of a wheel that is coming down and rolling. We can't get the full wheel, but like our body has actually adapted to mechanically simulate a wheel without being a wheel. Secondly, there are actual things that spin in the way that an engine spins. It's very unusual and very cool. It was actually, some scientists thought that it was not real, and it took a long time to prove and get scientific consensus around this. But bacterial flagella, like the little wiggly things that E. coli use to move around, actually function as a rotary engine. And it has like, it's got all the parts that like mechanical rotary engines have. And the flagella actually spins inside, and it spins perpetually at like 10,000 RPM, so extremely quickly, though they're very small, so it's easier to do it. And that's how bacteria move around. So there is that one example of a perpetually spinning engine in nature. It's very hard to scale up, of course, because twisting a body part, you have to have all the nerves and the blood vessels and the things that sort of feed it to make that work, which is why the motor inside of bacteria, like that thing that actually gets spun, isn't connected in any way except molecular, like through like molecular bonds, to the engine part that is doing the spinning.
That's pretty fascinating. You can learn more about that while we're promoting our work at Journey to the Microcosmos, Hank's amazing, extremely beautiful new YouTube series, where he speaks to me calmly about the microcosmos while I get to look at very small organisms and not think about the broader nightmare.
Yeah, just the very small nightmare that is the ocean of life that constantly surrounds us.
Right, but I'm used to thinking about that. That's nothing new for me.
This next question is from Giuliano, who asks, "Dear Hank and John, but mostly Hank, while we're doing me questions, I work at a coffee shop, and one of our regular customers is a conspiracy theorist.
Oh, great.
He is constantly coming in and telling us about all the lies that the government is feeding us. Seems very like a healthy thing to do to coffee shop employees. The one that makes me saddest is that he believes that space is a projection and that the stars and planets do not exist. How do I help this man understand that space exists? Only if you have enough life jackets, Giuliana."
You can't.
No, I think that it's pretty likely that this particular conspiracy theorist is really excited about believing things that are outside of reality, and that is empowering to them. And so taking that away, it would be perceived as a threat to their power.
Yep. I don't think there's much you can do in that situation except serve the coffee and wish that person the best. And
yeah,
in my experience anyway, unless it's somebody who's really close to the person, it's really difficult to make a meaningful impact.
Yeah, we've gotten an increasing number of messages about people who are dealing with conspiracy theorists who are more present in their lives than someone who comes into their coffee shop. And it's very hard, and I don't really know how to confront that. I don't even know if you're close with the person. I don't know how to confront it.
Yeah, we get a lot of questions from kids, from like 14 or 15 year old kids whose parents are, you know, believe that space is a projection, or that the stars aren't real, or that, or whatever, or chemtrails, et cetera, anti-vax stuff. We get a lot of messages about anti-vaccine concerns from kids who are like, how do I deal with this in my parent? And I wish that I knew what to say to them. It's really difficult because people's beliefs, it's one thing for instance, I believe that the Federal Reserve probably should not cut interest rates next quarter. Right? Like, that's a thing that I believe. I think that I'm right, but I also understand that I might be wrong. And it's not something that I believe so strongly that it becomes part of my identity. And if somebody disagrees with me, I say to them, like, what's wrong with you, you idiot? Right? Like, I understand that I might be wrong. Like, this is complicated stuff. There's lots of different cases to be made. But there are some things that I believe that are so central to my identity that when people challenge them, I do get really upset like that. And when people make, for instance, the idea that vaccines, you know, the MMR vaccine is dangerous or is a threat to the species or whatever, a central part of their identity, it's really, really hard to be able to talk to them about it, because any threat to that idea becomes a threat to their understanding of themselves.
And of reality. I think that a lot of these things come from like trying to make sense of reality and trying to make sense of, you know, like if you are a person who has dealt with loss and like how sort of terrible and tragic, like just, you know, the fact that we are all mortal is, sometimes people try to make sense of that by putting it on the like sort of medical establishment, as they might call it, and saying that there is some kind of conspiracy there and that like those people can't be trusted, when in kind of a way is like seeing them as an authority and wanting to have like some agency over that authority, when really what they want to have agency over is like illness and mortality, like which we would all love to have agency over those things. And so oftentimes it's like understanding where those things coming from can lead to enough understanding that will allow you to continue having a relationship with that person, and maybe enough understanding to, because I think that it is important to, like, if you can, to keep, you know, your family in your life, but also maybe enough understanding to like see this problem in a way that allows you to speak about it without immediately having those people feel the need to defend their beliefs and thus themselves, which only makes those beliefs stronger.
Yeah, it's a complicated problem. And I think when it's your parent or somebody who's really close to you, that's a different challenge from when it's someone at the coffee shop who you just, yeah, I think, have to wish well and hope that they do the right thing, which is always to leave at least a $1 tip. I guess probably only in the really United States it occurs to me. Like, it probably seems, yeah, very weird to our one Norwegian listener, Ole. That you would tip coffee shop workers. But yeah, you should. Also, I think coffee shops mean something else. This next question comes from Lauren, who writes, "Dear John and Hank, I totally just put Norway in the same boat as the Netherlands, and I have no regrets. They both start with N, and they're both in Europe, and whatever." Lauren writes,
"We're American.
Dear John," exactly.
"They don't pay us to know stuff. I don't know who they is. Well, I don't know what they pay us to do."
Do they pay us to not know stuff? Is there a way that I can get paid to be ignorant? I mean, other than cable news?
Burn. All right, let's get back at the podcast. We're in a rough spot. We're going to do it.
Yeah. This next question comes from Lauren, who writes, "Dear John and Hank, as a frequent listener to the pod, I'm also a frequent listener to the ads you run before and during the pod. What are SEO tools? Are they side-end option tools? So eternally, yeah, orange tools?"
No, you got it right first time. Side-end option. It's the different options for what you put your book and lamp on,
yes,
at the side of your bed.
Yeah, we want you to have all of the tools that you need to learn, mm-hmm, about all of the side-end options that are available to you. Lauren, you would not believe how many side-end tables you can get if only you follow all of the links,
yeah,
in our ads. The other one that she listed that I really liked was shark eliminating odor tools, which
I actually assumed that you had written these, and so I added that one myself.
Oh, no, I didn't. I didn't write them. I think Lauren wrote them.
Oh, I see.
She also signed off simply extrapolating options, Lauren.
Oh, it's very good. So, John, you know how when you go to the beach,
yeah,
and you have a problem where your child comes back from the beach and has in every possible area very small rocks?
Right.
Well, that is when you need sand-enriched offspring tools.
It's search engine optimization. So when you Google something or Yahoo something, but let's face it, more likely Google something, the list comes up a certain way because of search engine optimization tools, which are a bit of a dark, yeah, art in the world of the internet, and I don't, mm-hmm, understand them very well, but I think they are important, which is why, like, when you read, for instance, the show notes to Dear Hank and John, it's always like, Hank Green and John Green discuss, because people search for our names more than they search for Dear Hank and John, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But the weird thing about search engine optimization is that the idea is that, you know, you feed the algorithm the information that it wants, but the algorithm is trying desperately to not respond only to information that it wants, but it can't help itself. Yeah. And so we end up with an internet that's optimized for Google.com rather than an internet that's optimized for like the human users of Google.com.
Yes, you definitely see this with YouTube, where there was a certain period of time where it became really beneficial to not respect your viewers' time and to just drag out the length of your video as long as possible. And YouTube would be like, hey, people are watching this longer. And I'm like, God, could you just edit it at all?
Yeah, right. Me watching something longer doesn't necessarily mean that I like it more. It just means that I'm willing to sit here.
It's one of my pet peeves. As a person who has worked very hard to say a lot of stuff in 4 minutes, I feel very old.
You're very old. You sound like an old man yelling at the cloud right now.
I am. And by the cloud, I don't mean the thing in the sky. I mean the computer that's inside of a server somewhere.
Not nearly as cloud. Good as the Centaur for disease control as dad jokes go.
All right. This next question comes from Ariella, who asks, Dear Hank and John, climate change is real.
Agreed.
God, we're all on the same page. As a nation and a species, we've mobilized against many lesser issues in much larger ways. Is this a marketing issue? Do we need to market climate change like an aggressive threat? Should all of the Earth's graphic design and rhetorical resources be allocated to this? Glad I'm not under the sea, Ariella. But if you were under the sea, you'd have less to worry about, except for the acidification.
You know what just occurred to me?
No, I don't.
In The Little Mermaid, when they're like, it's better down here where it's wetter under the sea, don't they mean in the sea? Like, if you're under the sea...
I see what you're saying.
Aren't you in the dirt or whatever it is that's underneath the sea?
So, like, the sea ends at the sea floor and then...
And then you're under the sea. You don't want to be under
the mud.
Sea.
Yeah, because it's not better there. It's not wetter. It's less wet because it's muddier.
You want to be above under the sea, but below over the sea.
Right. We're over the sea. There's probably some worms and stuff under the sea. Ariel is in between those two places.
Yeah. I just want to call attention to what I see as the greatest failure of our time, Ariella, which is that
super,
the Little
super
Mermaid
accurate.
Doesn't use the right preposition when describing her relationship with the sea. What was your question? Oh, right. Yeah, so climate change is real. And one of the challenges, but I actually think not the major challenge, one of the challenges is that lots of people don't think that it's an important development in human history or that it's going to cause big disruptions in the human story. And I think some of that is because the future is unpredictable and people know the future is unpredictable. And so that's an element of it. I do think that some of it is a failure of marketing. And if you look, for instance, at the way that we handle cigarette smoking in the United States, it used to be that people just assumed that everyone was going to smoke cigarettes and there was not much you could do to move the smoking rate because people who smoked really liked smoking and it was really hard to quit because of the physical addiction. But we had this incredible public information campaign that dramatically reduced the percentage of cigarette smokers in the United States because of that public information campaign. And I think we could do that with climate change. I think we will do it eventually, but we can't do it as like individuals, or I don't think we can have as big an impact as individuals. I think we need the support of big institutions like nation states.
Yeah, I often think about how we could get more interest behind issues through good design and rhetoric that we use. We use it mostly to like sell Tic Tacs, which are fine.
Yeah.
But it like that's where most of that energy and those resources go. And I often think like if, you know, there's a lot of resources that go to selling bottled water and like very little that goes to selling tap water. Like no one markets tap water as like a good, cool thing that's good. And I think it's part of the reason why bottled water sells well is because tap water doesn't have a marketing budget.
No, absolutely. The incentives are to increase the total amount of consumption, which is good for economic growth in a narrow sense, but is likely very, very bad for the long, long-term future of the species. Mm-hmm. I do think that it's changing. I think more people are concerned correctly about climate change. I don't know that it will change fast enough. I think the biggest thing is that we've got to accept the reality that in the short run, this is going to involve really significant sacrifice. And
yeah.
And that's a hard thing for people to accept, especially when there are everyday problems. Like, the problems that are all around us are real. It's just that the climate change problem is also real and has potentially catastrophic consequences.
Yeah, and I think that there is sometimes a mistake that, like, the solution is easy, but it does require, you know, a scaling back of economic growth to some extent, and that has consequences. But it's about whether or not we as a species, kind of for the first time ever, can look more than a few years down the road. And that, you know, to the extent that we manage to do it, I think that it will be something that we as a species have never done before. And maybe already, to some extent, like, we are working on a problem beyond the scale of any we have yet faced, which is somewhat inspiring and somewhat hopeful. It's just that, like, we have not gotten anywhere near the amount of action that is necessary, which is hard.
Yeah. I don't think that despair is the correct response, though.
No.
I think that it's not continuing productive. To work is the correct response.
Yeah.
Sorry, I was starting to feel despair. I was talking to myself, not to you, to be clear. This next question comes from Steven, who writes, "Dear John and Hank, why are car horns so primitive? Shouldn't we have amazing, adjustable, super customizable car horns by now? Mm. For example, shouldn't I be able to dial in my aggravation level before sounding my car horn, similar to the way I can dial in my sense of how frequently the windshield wipers should do their thing?" That's a great point. Like, we have customizable windshield wipers, yeah, but we only have one car horn. Imagine the possibilities. Even, comma, Steven. Hank, mm-hmm, this brings me, mm-hmm, to my $1 million idea for the week.
Okay, it's time for a $1 million idea. John brought a $1 million idea. I got one from Twitter as well, but first we're going to start with John.
Okay, so you know how everybody has a blood type?
Sure.
I think that along with the rest of your medical record, mm-hmm, you should register a favorite song. And then when the day comes when you need an ambulance, as the, uh-huh, ambulance drives, instead of playing those horrible blaring sirens,
oh my God,
the ambulance plays your favorite song. So, like, you don't have to, like, in this time of crisis, be listening to the worst possible sound. Instead, you're just listening to a very loud version of Old Town Road.
Yeah, I'm going to take my horse to the Old Town Road, by which I mean my seriously incapacitated body to the hospital.
Exactly. You know, like, I just think, I mean, like, how has this not already happened? It is a clear, unambiguous $1 million idea. So
I love it so much. What is yours, Old Town Road?
No, probably not. Although, I mean, so Sarah's argument, uh-huh, when I told her this $1 million idea, she had a few concerns.
Uh-huh.
First, she was concerned that people wouldn't update their favorite song, and so they would, like, end up having the last song that they hear be, like, mm-hmm, their, you know, their song with their ex-wife or something.
Right, sure. Or the thing that they really loved when they set up their insurance card when they were 16.
Totally. But my counterargument to that argument is that, like, wouldn't it actually motivate you to go in and update your medical record more frequently if you knew that you were also setting your awesome ambulance song?
Yeah, it's I like it. I also like it from the external perspective of, like, it humanizes the person in the ambulance.
Exactly. I'm, you, like, want to get out of the way because you're like, oh my God, it's another Barbara Streisand fan.
It's a person in there.
Right.
It's just a huge B-52s fan coming down the road.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, Steven, I think you're onto something with the, mm-hmm, car horn business, but I don't think you've taken it far enough.
Right, exactly. I mean, I don't know how much time Steven has between, like, when something occurs and when Steven would like to honk, because for me, that there's no time. It's an instantaneous. I don't have a time to adjust my windshield wipers in that moment.
No, but I would like my every honk to not be a honk sound. Like, I would love it if instead of just a regular honking sound, when I hit the car horn, my car said something like, "Hey, get out of here."
Like, well, what I do need is a button that says the light is green.
Yes.
Because that's 90% of times that I honk.
Right.
No one in this town pays attention when they're stopped at a light. They just sit there.
Okay. So My Chevrolet Volt, Hank, actually has that button. So
really?
Chevrolet Volt's the perfect car.
Oh, I gotta go
come
get a Volt.
With an emergency honker that honks like a regular honker. But there's also a mm-hmm. button on the side that you can hit that's just like, hey-o, hey, just letting you know, hi. Just in case you're nice. Curious, you might want to look up from your phone. It's a green light.
I think my siren song would definitely be I'm Alive by ELO. Oh. So you could just like be going down the road and it's like, it's both speaking to me in the ambulance in this moment when I need an ambulance.
Right.
Telling me that I am alive, but also everybody around, like the person in the ambulance is alive.
Right.
And also that song is so, it rocks so hard.
I might go with that disco hit, I Will Survive, you know? At first
yeah,
I was
sure,
afraid,
sure,
I was
sure.
petrified.
Or Hold On by Wilson Phillips.
Oh, that's another
just
good one.
Like, yeah.
I'm glad, Hank, I'm really glad that you agree with me that my $1 million idea is a $1 million idea because
it's so good.
Yeah.
All right. I love it. I don't know how to monetize it. No idea how to monetize it.
We'll figure that out. Hank, have we ever known how to monetize anything? No. We'll figure it out. What's the $1 million idea you got off Twitter?
All right. So this is Ian's $1 million idea from Twitter. It was posted earlier today. You know what would be a good idea for a company? You send them your favorite pair of pants,
yeah.
and they copy them exactly to make you your perfect pants. It's called Pants Clone.
That is the... Forget about ambulance songs. That is the best idea I've ever heard in my entire life. How has
so
that not
good.
Already happened?
I know. It sounds very expensive, like to deconstruct and reconstruct a pair of pants. But there are so many rich people in the world.
Like, look, it can't cost more than $200 per pair of pants, right?
I don't know. I don't know how much labor goes into, like, doing a CT scan of your pants, basically.
I would love that. I'm wearing my favorite pants right now, which means that I won't be wearing them 5 days this week, and it's such a bummer. Ian,
well, I have a solution to that problem, John, which is wear your pants for 5 days in a row, like everyone else.
Well, but then they start to get so baggy that they're not my favorite pair of pants anymore.
Oh,
they're a different
I hear
pair of
ya.
Pants.
Uh-huh.
I like my pair of pants to just hug my legs in all the right ways and none of the wrong ones. I love this idea from Ian. That is an actual $1 million idea. I wish I knew how to, like, I would invest in that company tomorrow. If somebody out there is making a highly customized pants clone pants company, hit me up.
Pantsclone.com isn't even taken, John.
Oh my God. Hank, maybe we should just do it. You know, like, maybe we should just do it.
John, this next question comes from Sarah, who asks, Dear Hank and John, I was cleaning out my fridge today and noticed that my jar of red curry paste doesn't expire for almost 700 years. This has made me think a lot about my own mortality as well as that of the earth. Do you think that this red curry paste is going to outlast the human race? And most importantly, how do I get rid of this? I don't want to have a jar of red curry paste until I die. And have to bequeath it to someone in my will. I'm very curious to hear your thoughts, Sarah. P.S. I'm looking forward to attending your mini tour in Minneapolis. John, I think that there's a misprint just to get out ahead of it.
Well, I mean, you don't think that there's a misprint. There is a factual misprint.
But, like, more importantly, there's a very easy way to get rid of red curry paste, and it is to use it in its desired fashion. Make it into poop.
Yeah. No, I mean, you should eat the curry paste. We all agree about that. There's no question that you should eat the curry paste. Mm-hmm. It's fine for years, for as long as you need it.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I do. I mean, I'm guessing that it says that it goes bad in 2719, which means that it probably goes bad in 2019. So you probably scarf down that red curry paste, not like with a spoon or anything, but...
But even if it says it goes bad in 2019, it doesn't really go bad until at least 2020. We're talking about curry paste. We're not talking about milk.
Right. There's that viral image of Himalayan sea salt that has an expiration date on it, and it's just like, it's a rock. It's rock. It's millions of years old rock.
Right. I mean, to be fair,
it was from when the Himalayas were in the ocean. That's how it's going to be okay.
Yeah, I think you can eat the curry paste, and I don't think you need to worry about your own mortality happening before right. you finish the curry paste, unless there's something that you know that we don't.
Well, it is all often, I think it's something that people are a little freaked out by when they realize that, like, the plastic bottle that you drink your Diet Dr. Pepper out of is going to be on the earth for longer than you. That is a little bit upsetting, but there it is.
Yep.
Get used to it. You're going to die. And plastic lasts forever, so use less of it.
It doesn't last forever. It just lasts for hundreds of thousands of years. It will last much longer than our species, that's for sure.
And at the moment, we're recycling very little of it.
Hank, when you think about where we are in the human story,
mm-hmm.
like Tuatara have been around for 250 million years.
Yep.
Humans have been around for 250,000 years.
Yep.
Where do you think we are percentage-wise? Like, are we in the first quarter?
We actually did a SciShow video about this, so there's a number of different ways of looking at it, but, like, the way that you're asking is just, like, my opinion. Gosh, I really want to be hopeful.
I think it's hopeful to say that we're in the third quarter. We might have different definitions of hope.
Yeah, I want us to be around for 250 million years, John.
If we're in the third quarter, that would mean that there are like 1,000 generations of humans to come after me.
Yeah, it's true. But it'd be great if we had the lifespan of a Tuatara. But, like, we are a lot more complicated than Tuatara in terms of, like, what we can accomplish. So I think it's really hard. It's just really hard to know. Like, nothing on Earth has ever happened like us. We are a unique thing, a unique occurrence in the history of Earth. And so we have no idea. There is no way to get that data.
This is like when I asked President Barack Obama if I should name my daughter Eleanor or Alice, and he wouldn't bite.
Yeah, no. I just, I hope that there is less and less suffering every year forever.
Well, I've got good news and bad.
That's how I answer every question from now on.
That'd be a great...
Play it safe.
That'd be a great, like, presidential answer, too, if somebody were like, yeah. What's your policy on healthcare spending? And you'd be like, you know what we need to do? Reduce the overall amount of human suffering. And that's what I'm going to do when I'm president. I'm going to reduce human suffering. I've only got one platform, and it's reduce
human
suffering.
I like pie!
All right, Hank, we have another question. This one's from Abby, who writes, Dear John and Hank, I caught a frog just for fun, and now it's in my mom's car, and I can't find it. What do I do, Abby? Abby, I just want to say how much I appreciate the fact that your question was short. It contained no extraneous information, but it also didn't contain, like, too little information. You didn't leave anything out. It's the perfect question.
Yeah, because my first question would be, why did you catch a frog? And you say, just for fun.
Yeah.
Which is, I guess, the only reason.
No, I mean, you might, for instance, be trying to generate a prince. You might
right,
be...
Right, yes, there's that.
You remember when we were kids that people believed if you licked the back of a certain toad, you could have a hallucinogenic experience?
That is actually true. They're just, those toads don't live in Florida.
Oh, boy, I licked a lot of toads for no reason then.
Yeah, only one of them turned into a man. But that's not what you were going for at all. Yeah, it could be like post-apocalypse and you are really hungry. That's another reason to catch a frog.
There's a bunch of reasons to catch a frog, but we know why Abby caught that frog, which was just for fun. And now it's in Abby's mom's car and she can't find it. What do I do?
I would like to know how big the frog is, because there are some very small frogs in the world. Some are so small that they could get into a place in a car that a human cannot get to, but also so small that when that frog dies there, it will not be of consequence.
So here's my theory, Abby. There's a 99% chance that this frog is going to get out of that car. And let me tell you how I know. I know because just today, a mouse ate some of my peanut M&Ms out of my car. So I know for a fact that mice can get into and out of cars. So can frogs. That's the end of the story.
Yeah, that's how you lost the frog. The frog is gone. The frog is out. The frog was like, I was just caught just for fun. I am not being a party to this nonsense anymore.
By the way, you know who wasn't just having fun? The frog.
Yeah, the frog. Yes.
Meanwhile, the frog goes back to like its frog family and is like, so I've had a day.
I mean, what? So the only other thing that you can do here is like sneak out at 2 o'clock in the morning with your iPhone fully charged, turn on that flashlight and go through every inch of this car trying to find a frog. I don't think that there are frog traps that like are good, like have a good outcome for the frog. So you don't want that. I think you have to search the frog. And then your mom comes out and like, what are you doing with your iPhone in the car? And you're like, you got to just say that you're like out there smoking marijuana or something less incriminating than the actual situation.
I'm just licking the back of some hallucinogenic toads, Mom. No big deal. Definitely not looking for a frog in your car. That wouldn't be like me not at all. Yeah, nope. It's just not going to be that big of a deal. Here's what's going to eventually happen, Abby. Your mom's either going to find a frog or a frog carcass, and your mom will be like, oh my God, I found a toad in the car today. And you'll be like, Mom, I'm pretty sure it was a frog, actually.
And then that was your mistake.
And that's how you're going to get found out. It's like a Columbo moment where your mom's going to be like,
Well then. Oh, God, John, which reminds me that this podcast is brought to you by Secret Car Toads. You got that secret car toad. You're hoping it gets out of the car, but maybe it doesn't. Now it's just a secret you have to keep for your whole life.
Pretty good name for a band, Secret Car Toads.
I'd listen.
Today's podcast is also brought to you by Personalized Ambulance Songs. Personalized Ambulance Songs, John's first proper million-dollar idea.
And this podcast, of course, is also brought to you by Space. Space! It definitely exists!
It does. Not only do we have a bunch of satellites up there, we've sent persons.
Yeah, human beings.
And chimpanzees, a number of species. Do they think that there's no rover on Mars? I guess they don't think that there's a Mars.
Yeah, no. I mean, there are people who think that the Earth is flat, but the other planets aren't, John.
Oh, well, that doesn't hold up to scrutiny. I don't know how else to respond to that. And today's podcast is brought to you by Super Experimental Orchid Tools. Super Experimental Orchid Tools, the most important SEO tools available today.
Yeah. I mean, how else are you going to get your super experimental orchids happy?
We also have a Project Frosted message from Dan for Etvid. Hey, Dad, I'm on the pod. Well, vicariously anyway. I just wanted to say how glad I am to have the chance to bring you into this weird subculture. It's not often that we share similar tastes, but having this between us has been an amazing experience, and I don't think I say that often enough. Thank you for being the absolute best, Dad. With love, Dan. Dan, I'm just going to rewrite the end of your Project Frosted message real quick. I love you, Dad. Dan. It's so hard to say that to our dad sometimes, Dan, but it's really important. So I thought that I would just do it.
That was really sweet. I liked it a lot.
That is sweet. Thank you both for being part of this community and for sharing it with each other.
John, I have another question for you. It comes from Claire, who asks, Dear Hank and John, I was just at Hank's paperback release show in Austin. Thank you for coming. It was super fun. And while waiting for the show to start, the mother of a friend of mine that I made in line offered me Tic Tacs. Only she mentioned that she had to sneak them in since the venue didn't allow food. This seemed wrong to me, as I do not consider Tic Tacs to be food. They have calories, but like, so does dirt. However, everyone there seemed to disagree with me. Please settle this. Are Tic Tacs food? Fly me to the moon, Claire.
P.S. Thanks for the Tic Tac, Tierney's mom. I think the P.S. was very important.
Sorry. Yes, it's good.
Hank, I think that you will agree with me that Tic Tacs are not food. Altoid mints are not food. And gum is not food. And so you can bring, in fact, you must bring all of those things into events like, for instance, our mini tour on August 16th and August 18th in respectively Madison and Minneapolis, because they are not food.
I see where you're going here.
And if
here.
You want them during the show, you will have no other way to acquire them.
I have to posit that mint Tic Tacs are not food, but orange Tic Tacs are.
That is the kind of BS that is destroying this country. Did I ratchet it up too much? I can't tell.
Yeah, because like a mint, you can just have mints in your pocket, and that's fine. But an orange Tic Tac is basically an orange.
Hank, do you want to know how many calories are in an orange-flavored Tic Tac? It's going to blow your mind.
One.
None.
That's not
true. So they're not food. End of story.
They're rounding. They're rounding yes. peculiarly.
They're not food. They're a rounding error.
So I think that like Tic Tacs are food in that if you eat them, they are metabolized like food. They are not food.
It's two.
In that they
it's
are
two.
Not.
I was wrong.
It's two.
It's two. Okay. Probably should have researched that before sounding so authoritative.
Yeah. It's 2019, John. You don't have to actually know things to say them.
Hank, before we get to the all-important news from Mars and AFC Wimbledon, and I mean, our great national nightmare is over and AFC Wimbledon season has begun again. But before we get there, I need to read you this very important email that we received from Kelly. Hello, Brothers Green. Just to help alleviate your grossed-outedness at saying Ralph Lauren, you were right the first time. His name is actually pronounced Lauren, like the woman's name.
Oh.
Source, I was an executive assistant at RLHQ for a while when I first moved to New York and worked with the CFO as well as the EVP of Women's Design and met Ralph on a number of occasions, mostly regarding bringing him food in lunch meetings. I have not to date been in an elevator with him. I'm also the Getty photographer who photographed both of you in San Francisco on the Turtles All the Way Down tour. Thanks for being rad. Kelly.
Well, thanks for the photo. Next time you are in the same room as Ralph Lauren, can you ask him what the joke that Rachel made was?
Also, Kelly, I have to say that I very rarely remember anything that happens in my life, but I do remember being photographed by you in San Francisco because you did such a great job and made both Hank and me feel so at ease and happy. So thank you. It is a really wonderful memory. I hope that we did okay as subjects. All right, Hank, I'll start.
Okay,
don't
you
worry.
Go.
AFC Wimbledon are back in League One, the third tier of English football.
Yep.
We survived on goal difference last season.
Mm-hmm.
Our season has started. And you know what, Hank?
Yeah.
On the morning of August 1st, I woke up and I saw that AFC Wimbledon was at the tippy-tippy top of the League One table in first place. And you know why?
Alphabetical order.
Alphabetical order. We played our first game against Rotherham. And we lost. We did score a goal, which was encouraging, and it was a good it was a good goal. Joe Piggott scored it, which is encouraging too, because it means he still plays for AFC Wimbledon and has not been sold yet to a club in a higher division. We gave up a really dumb, annoying goal in the 29th minute, and then we scored a kind of beautiful goal mouth scrambly goal at the start of the second half, and it looked like AFC Wimbledon were on their way to a opening day draw, but then in the 84th minute, we gave up a goal.
Ugh.
Clark Robertson scored for Rotherham, and they won 2-1. Now, you'll recall that last season, 2-1 was the exact scoreline that we lost like 30 games by. Hopefully, that is not going to be a tradition moving forward. This weekend, or in the past, as people are listening to it, we will be playing Fleetwood, a game that is theoretically much more winnable than our first game.
Okay.
Even though Fleetwood is currently standing atop League One, it's only after one game played. I think we can win this one. We are going to have to start winning games at some point. But, Hank, but despite the fact that we did not win our first game, we are out of the relegation zone in 16th place because several teams lost their games by more points.
Oh, all right. Middle of the pack.
There you go.
Is that right? Is it the middle of the pack?
Middle of the pack.
Okay. I was right. Well, John, in news from Mars, at the end of July, SpaceX got its Starhopper to hop. Do you know about the Starhopper, John?
Yeah.
It is a prototype version of the Starship, the tall stainless steel rocket that SpaceX continuously renders on the surface of Mars, looking very cool. And SpaceX hopes to use it to send humans to Mars one day before 2028. So scientists at SpaceX wanted to see if the Starhopper could actually fly. So they've been trying to make those tests happen, but that has been a rocky start. The whole plan was to get the rocket to gently lift off the ground about 60 feet and then to gently touch back down. First, there was a weird fireball on the launch pad that delayed the test a few days. And then the first test ended extremely quickly when the rocket shot flames out of the tip.
Oh, boy.
And then finally, when they tested it again the next day, the SpaceX team was able to get the Starhopper to do its 60-foot hop All of these tests are just in preparation for the actual rocket that SpaceX hopes to send up. So they've also been working in Florida to create more space for a launch pad that will be used when the Starship is ready for liftoff. So SpaceX Starhopper has hopped one hop closer to the Starship being a real thing with real humans into it, really taking people really safely to Mars.
That would be really cool after 2028.
It doesn't matter what the podcast is called, John. It matters that we're brothers and that we love each other.
Do you think, if you had to make a bet today, do you think that it will be a private company, SpaceX or other, that gets the first human to Mars, or do you think it will be a national government?
No, I think it's going to be a national government. Yeah. I think that, of course, there will be many private subcontractors, which there were, you know, have always been in the space program.
Right.
And SpaceX, I'm sure, will be involved in that one way or another. But no, I don't think that like Elon Musk is going to come up with $1 trillion to send people to Mars.
You know what I just found out? I just found out that two of the teams in League One, the third tier of English football, for being naughty or having debt or something, I can't really follow it, are starting out with negative 12 points.
Wow. That's great news.
And obviously, you never root against anyone for any reason. Dot, dot, dot.
Is it any of the what kind of teams are they?
It's Bolton and Barry. I mean,
are they going to like dig out of that hole pretty easily?
Not based on the results of their first games.
All right.
So,
wow,
we'll see.
Negative 12 points.
Maybe that'll make it a smidge easier for us to hang around. But who knows?
Who knows?
Who knows? Life is full of twists and turns, and the 2019-2020 EFL League One season will be no exception.
John, thank you for making a podcast with me. It's always good to have you there in my life when the world is a little tattered around the edges.
Same.
So thank you.
Same.
And thank you, everybody, for listening. This podcast is edited by Joseph Tuna Medish. It's produced by Rosianna Hals-Rojas and Sheridan Gibson. Our editorial assistant is Deboki Chakravarti, which is a new name to add to the list. Thanks for helping us find cool stuff to think about and talk about. Our head of community and communication is Victoria Bongiorno. The music you're hearing now and at the beginning of the podcast is by the great Gunnarola. And as they say in our hometown,
don't forget to be awesome.